Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Natureversity Podcast. And today I am joined with James Michael of Lime Hollow Nature Center and a bunch of other nature schools around the country, because you've been getting around, brother.
I'm trying to.
It's good, right? All the different mentors and experiences that we share in these different opportunities. So, yeah, well, I'm excited to have you. Thanks so much. You're about to be out of Austin, Texas, and I'm really happy to catch you before you depart. And where are you headed?
So I'll be heading up to New York to Lime Hollow Nature Center.
There it is. And where were you born? Tell us about James Michael. Who are you? Where were you born? How'd you grow up? Give us all the information about
who
your
are
life.
You? That's a deep philosophical question. Where am I from, though? Well, I grew up in Long Island, New York. I was born in El Salvador, and when I was really young, I was adopted. I was adopted immediately. Like, my parents knew I was going to be born, and my adoptive father flew down to El Salvador, and he was there for my birth, and he stayed there for a couple of months, and then he flew back with me to the United States after a little while. And then I just grew up in Long Island, yeah.
Wow. And Long Island, was that, like, city? Was that big parks? What was the outdoorsy like?
Yeah, out Long there. Island. It's a big suburban sprawl. Yeah. It's very, well, I can't say there's no nature. There are trees and there's fields and stuff, but it's not like you would see out west or in the Midwest. It's very, there's just houses all stacked right next to each other. And then in between those houses might be like a tiny little thin patch of woods that's like 2 feet or maybe like a foot, not even, depending on the area that you are. And there are some areas where there are parks, but they're very small, like maybe 2 or 3 acres at best. And, yeah, it was just not much nature where I was. I was in the center of Long Island growing up in a place called Lake Grove. But if you look at Long Island and you go further out east, you go towards Montauk, and Long Island looks like a big old fish. And when you start getting towards the fish's tail, where it forks, then you have more wilderness and farmland and vineyards and lots of shipping industry and fishing, and that's where the nature starts to come back.
Very cool. Yeah, and were your parents like, hey, go outside a lot, or did they not really care? Were they, like, how was it? Did you go to, like, so in New York they have, like, PS, like, 114, and is that, like, public school?
No, we didn't have PS schools for me. I went to a place called Center Reach High School. And I went to the Suffolk County School District. As far as, like, being encouraged to go out into the outdoors, not at all. My parents were nothing close to being outdoors people at all.
Really?
Yeah, I had no exposure, really, except for just through movies, social media,
so
whatever
existed. So no camping?
Never camped in my life, no.
Wow.
Yeah, I had no experience with it growing up.
That's amazing. And so you were in high school. What brought you outside?
The love for adventure. I was very impressionable when I was little, and I saw Jurassic Park when I was probably like 5 or 6 years old.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah, greatest movie in my opinion of all time. And when I saw the movie, I was just filled with this sense of wonder, like, oh my God, these creatures exist out there. I wasn't even focused on the mayhem or violence that was happening. I was just like, I want to see dinosaurs. Like, that's cool. And anytime I'd get in a car ride or be going to school or something, or I see a little patch of woods, I'd always be like, maybe there's dinosaurs in there or weird hidden things in these little patches of woods. And I just wanted to explore it. And so that sense of wonder that was cultivated from that movie was really like the jumping point for me.
Wow. Yeah. Movies are very inspirational, and it's almost like we're using old tales, like sitting around a campfire, and we've replaced that sitting around the campfire and hearing from elders with movies, because for us, right?
Yeah.
Because that's what happened to me. I was like really into Lost, that TV show.
That's
that
an guy, awesome show.
John Locke or whatever. Yeah. And he's like on this plane, and, you know, he's like, I'm gonna fucking hunt this boar with a knife, right?
I was all about Sawyer, like, steal all the resources.
Oh, no, you're terrible.
Oh, yeah,
no,
I loved it. Just Sawyer's kidding. The best.
The concept, though, was adventure. It was really, I think, an old innate code that we all have in us.
Yeah.
The DNA sequence of being human, right? Which is go out and meet struggle. Maybe it's just for men. Guy, because I don't know that women want to go out there and put themselves on the line like that. But we as boys, right? Like, I had that same exact concept. I was like 18 when Lost came out. So all I had
that
was
early 2000s, right? Something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was exactly. I was born in 85. So, yeah, I was just, I was enamored. I was excited. I was like, what if I just had a knife? And then they hit you with this concept of what he's doing in the show. He's like doing what right, it's called a walkabout. And you're like, wait, you can do that? You can do that?
Right, no, but you got to go to Australia for it.
Yeah, but why? Why couldn't I do it here in America? And that's when I knew. And that's how I found Tom Brown.
So so Lost was it for you?
Yeah, Lost and my buddy Harlan's Bookstore.
Okay.
So I was like really big into conspiracy theories. Right?
Oh, nice. Me too.
And reading, you know, occultic history and all that type of stuff is always fascinating for me. But eventually I started thinking like, well, what the hell is this going to do for me? So I gave it all up. And when I was giving all my books to my buddy Harlan, I was at this bookstore and I was just like, well, there's like a homesteading and survival area of your bookstore. And I walked over there and this book just like hit me in the face. Like, here it is, grandfather. And my grandfather was a huge part of my life growing up.
Yeah.
So I ended up taking this book, and that was it, man. I ran with it.
Yeah.
So you were in high school, no connection to nature. You saw Jurassic Park at a young age. You knew since you were five that you wanted to adventure. And when was like the first taste of quote unquote adventure for you? What was your moment?
It's funny. I've often questioned that myself. Like, how did I get to where I am? I like to reflect a lot on my past and my actions and just how I developed into the human I am. And I feel like when I was 15 years old, it was ninth grade, just finished, going into the summer of that year, going into 10th grade. And I knew I wanted adventure, and I thought survival was cool, but I didn't know the word survival. I never understood that word, and I didn't even know that it existed in the real world anymore as an occupation or something that people could do. And then my older brother, Michael, he's got to be like maybe 10 to 15 years older than me, I don't know. He was an adult by the time I started, like, being able to remember anything. And he was watching a TV show called Survivor Man. Coolest TV show ever at the time for me. And it was my first time seeing it, and it was when Survivor Man was in the Northern Boreal, and he was simulating a plane crash and an injury. I'm sure you remember that episode. Yeah. Super good. And I remember I watched it as a 15-year-old, and I was like, holy crap, this is amazing. Like, I didn't know this was a thing anymore. I thought this is stuff we associated with mountain men and people who lived prior to the 18th century. It just was completely foreign to me that anyone could do this anymore. And I became enthralled by it. And my aunt, she and her husband, my uncle, they are both educators in college. And I don't know exactly what they teach. I know they do a lot with writing and literature. But they, my aunt had taken some ethnobotany courses, and I don't remember where she did them, but she learned some plants, and she heard that I was interested in the stuff, and that I was also going to be hanging out with them for the summer for like 2 weeks, going from Plattsburgh, New York, near Lake Champlain, up to Vermont, where their daughter was. And I was like, yeah, I like plants, I like survival, like I want to understand how to do this stuff. And she was like, well, let me teach you some things. And so she showed me like plantain and
what year was
wood
that?
Sorrels. This had to be, man, when was ninth grade? Maybe 2005, something like that.
Okay, so it was like a year. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Got it.
And so I started learning these plant species as we were on this summer trip, and I just started feeling this sense of empowerment and also just wonder like, oh my God, this can be done, and I'm actually learning how to survive in the wilderness. And I went from this period of ignorance to now this sense of like, okay, I'm starting to learn things, but now is in a period of confusion because I didn't know how to do any of these things. There was no schools that I was aware of. I didn't have any books. There was just like one TV show that where Survivor Man was showing these skills, but it was not educational in the way that like he's like, let me break down how to do bow drill. So I had ignorance where I just didn't know what survival was. And then I knew what survival was, but I didn't know where to start with it. And so my aunt was kind of like a little gateway to showing me a little bit about that stuff. And as we were taking the ferry to Plattsburgh, I remember I had my first sit spot. I didn't know it was called a sit spot at the time.
Ah.
And have you ever heard of Champy, the lake monster?
No.
Okay, so apparently there's a lake monster in Lake Champlain called Champy. And just like you, I was into conspiracy theories and cryptozoology and all that. And I was like, I got to see Champy. And so we stopped at this park, and I sat on this boulder that just like extended out into the water. And as I was sitting there, I was like, maybe 15, 20 minutes, I'll just see its head pop up and I'll be able to see, like, yes, I saw a champion, just tell the world. And as I was sitting there really quietly, just waiting for this event to happen, this little creature, this furry creature, just came out onto the boulder, no more than like 6 or 7 inches from me. And it sat there, it looked at me, and then it turned around and just went back into the woods. And the only thing that came to mind for a description, because I'd never seen it before, was a furry snake. It's just like, what the hell was that? And it was a long-tailed weasel. Oh. But I'd never heard of weasels. I'd never seen a weasel. And I just had this crazy experience. I was like, I just discovered a new creature. It was amazing. And I remember I told my aunt about it, and she was like, oh, it was probably some sort of weasel thing. And I was like, the hell's a weasel? Oh, and so wow. I was like, can we, like, figure this stuff out? And so when we got to Plattsburgh, she took me to a bookstore. Well, it was an antique bookstore, so it had a lot of books, but it also had, like, you know how in the front they got glass counters with stuff in the inside where you're not supposed to touch it? Well, one of the things I saw in there was knives. And then so we went into the bookstore, and my aunt and uncle went to the back to look at all the books. And I was just like, let me look at these knives right here.
Uh-huh.
And I had all of grandma's Christmas money saved up in my pocket.
Yes.
And there is this old dude. He had to be like in his 60s or 70s. And it said on the sign, you can't sell knives to minors. And I was just like, screw it, I'm going to wing it. Let's see if I can pull this off. And I went up to him and I was like, hey, can I purchase one of these knives? And he was like, hell yeah, which one do you want?
No.
And I was like, yes, I found the right old man. And I there was this beautiful K-bar fighting knife, a legit Marine Corps fighting knife. And it was in perfect condition. It had the nice old leather sheath, and it looked legitimately like it was from World War II. And I was like, can I buy that one? And he was like, yeah, that's only $100. I was like, damn it, like that's more than I have in my pockets. I can't afford this. And he was like, well, we got some cheaper knives here. And so I looked at the cheaper knives, and any knife to me at that point was this amazing treasure, because my parents did not use knives. I wasn't allowed to even cut my own steak till I was like 13 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. I was very sheltered in that way.
Interesting.
And so I didn't know how to use a knife. And he handed me this crappy, it was a real piece of shit Bowie knife. I mean, this thing was falling apart, rattling, but to me, I felt like I was wielding Excalibur. I was like, I'll take it.
Jurassic Park, here I come.
I was like, I'll go slay things with these. And so I bought this piece of shit Bowie knife. And then there was also this other knife that he had that looked really cool. It was a beautiful German hunting belt knife. It was probably about like 2.5-3 inches long in the blade. It was good German worked steel. And the handle was like stacked leather. It was well put together. And I wish I still had it, because it was probably the first good knife I ever had in my life. And I didn't know it at the time. And so, yeah, I remember I concealed them in my pocket when I went to my aunt and uncle. And they had finished perusing. And when I went to go look for a book, I found this awesome book, just like you, Tom Brown.
Yes.
It was his wilderness survival book. And I was like, whoa, now I can learn all these skills. I was looking through all the illustrations, like with the traps, the spears, the bows, the shelters. I was like, this is it. This is everything I need. And my aunt was like, yeah, I'll get that for you. And here's another book that I really like that I've been told about. And she handed me this book called Stalking the Wild Asparagus, which you have in your library.
Yes.
And Yule I was Gibbons. Like, cool. Yeah. Uh-huh. And I was like, great, now I'll know how to make all these tools and weapons and survive, and I'll have all the knowledge to be able to find food and make it delicious for myself. And so my aunt, and I don't know if she'll ever know it to this day, but she was such a huge inspiration in stoking that flame for me.
Yeah.
And so that's where I started really trying to learn all these things. But I was still stuck in that period of confusion, because, I mean, I looked at that bow drill 1,000 times in that book, and I still couldn't figure out how to do it. I had no idea how to do any of the things in the book, because it's not that well explained. But it's inspirational and it's cool, and I wanted to learn that stuff. So it was more of an inspirational book than a real technical guide for me to start learning these skills.
Yeah,
and that's when it really took off for me.
Dude, that's awesome, man. That was a good story. It's a lot of times family members give us that. It's when I chatted with Tom Elpel, he said the same thing. Like, it was just family members who showed him something cool one day, and he's like, whoa, I'm going to run with this.
Did you ever tell your mom what you wanted to do? Like,
yeah, I told her a couple of things, I'm sure. I think I told her I wanted to be a Navy SEAL.
Wanted to blow it's every child's up. Inspiration, young boy, yep.
Yeah.
like invade. But, you know, like I think I was 10th grade when 9/11 happened, mm-hmm. and you get all this like patriotic fervor, and you're like,
oh, there was flags on every door next
day. Let's go kill people, right? Because that's the solution. Right, yeah. So I was exactly. like, yeah, I want to be the covert person doing it, I guess. I don't want to get killed on the front line. So I didn't, I didn't have much interest except going like to do that. But then my grandfather was like, hell no, you ain't doing that, because he served in Vietnam.
Yeah.
He was a, you know, platoon
sergeant. So he knew the shit, yeah.
Yeah, he did a couple tours and made it out alive, fortunately. And then I didn't know what I was going to do. So, but my buddy Jack and I, we called Ninja, I made a couple jokes to him a few times, like about we should go learn to live like Native Americans.
Yeah.
Because we didn't like the whole, we were like reading conspiracy books and all that. And we were like, man, fuck this dominant culture. And, you know, we got into like Derek Jensen and like, oh, let's bomb
Derek
everything.
Derek Jensen, who's that?
Derek Jensen's kind of like, you know, people, I think, call him kind of like eco-terrorist. You know,
oh, okay.
In a way,
gotcha.
I wouldn't, that's maybe a bad label. He's a wonderful author. Let me first say that. And, but a lot of the publicity thing, cause he, you know, he advocates for destroying dominant culture, you know, mm-hmm. like in a roundabout way. That's what he's advocating for. If you read his books. And when he says that, he's basically talking about the exploitation of resources and
right,
things
gotcha.
Like that, how we go logging and we dam rivers and all that kind of stuff. And so I was into that stuff when I was younger, and I was like, that's the solution. But then as I began learning skills, I was like, wait a second. I was like, we need to use these skills to like unite communities, and then it's all going to be fine, because we'll all have the same. Because like, I don't want to log. Like, I don't want to put oil in rivers. Like, I don't want to dam them up. Like, I want salmon to be able to swim up and spawn. Like, I want all these things. And so that's just where I decided, because I think what happens in our life is we get this mission of like, well, we need to fix this in the world, right? We as young people. And we have these big liberal hearts. And then we go out and we say, how are we going to do that? And that was mine. I was like, education for other people about why you love the natural world. Because I think once you have a love for it, you want to protect it.
And that was from a young age you had that feeling?
Yeah. Well, from once I started learning it, like 18.
Okay,
yeah, like 18, 19. I definitely was like, yeah, this is what I feel.
That's funny. It was opposite
world.
For me. Total selfish ambitions.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you just, well, I mean, I did feel that too. I wanted to like just elite, because think about it, I can't smash the quote unquote dominant culture,
right? Yeah,
so you alleviate yourself from it, and the survival,
you pull yourself out of the situation,
right?
Yeah.
And that's what my goal was. And then when I went and did that in reality, I was like, wait a second, this is awful. These skills are supposed to unite communities, like, because that's what they did, fire and water and food and songs and dance and love and, you know, making pottery and all that stuff. Like, it was a part of something much bigger that I was like, this is selfish. And it took a vision quest to go do that. You
oh,
know?
That's cool.
So,
yeah,
I was out in California, and the first one I had like given up on with I didn't give up on it. I'd say I should have just stayed, but there was I got pulled out of it.
Yeah,
in my first vision quest with Dave at Earth Native, and then on this other one I did in California, I really was like, okay, I get it now. I know what I need to do. So,
they're
powerful. And so that was mine. But so when you got into your adventures, were you like, okay, I got this book, I got this knife, I've got some resources. Where in that moment were you like, I got to go to a survival school? Like, what was your first survival
school? That came way later. I just
stayed in that. How many years did you use those books and that knife?
Many years.
Really?
When I used them all up to wait till I was 18, and then I joined the military like literally week after I graduated high school. I mean, I was part of something called a poolee program, which is essentially a recruiting process where they will find people who are too young to sign up, and they will have them meet like weekly for a club where they'll work out and they'll inspire them. It's just a way of getting the kids in faster. That's all.
Are you
going to
say it's brainwashing?
Yeah, it's brainwashing. Yeah. And I was totally brainwashed because, you know, I watched movies like Rambo and Predator and Commando. And I was just like, that's how I can get this sense of adventure and survival. It's just like, I'll go join the military and I'll learn how to run through the jungles shirtless, fighting whatever, and throwing traps and killing aliens and getting all these top secret missions and exploring all these ruins. It was like, that's the life. And it was just not the reality.
No.
I remember when I went to boot camp, it was what I was looking for, and it was what I was expecting. And I knew a little bit about it because my brother had joined the Marines. And then when I went to infantry school, that's when I was like, all right, now I'm going to start using these skills, because now we're doing field exercises. We're hanging out in the wilderness. And like, why wouldn't I use these cool skills that Tom Brown's teaching to help enhance my own military training? And I remember one day we were doing a field exercise and we had finished early and I was by my tent and it was probably lunchtime, I think. And I went off and I built up my first rolling snare trap and I put peanut butter on it. And I caught a squirrel the next day.
No way.
Yeah, it was the coolest thing. I didn't think it would actually work, but it worked. And I showed my staff sergeant, and he looked at it, and he was like, get that fucking squirrel out of here. And I was like, is this not the coolest thing? Like, why are you so angry at me right now? He was
That's badass.
He was like, look, you don't need survival skills. We have supply trains for that. You're going to go to the middle of the desert. You don't need to know any of this stuff. And I was like, all right. And so I kind of just gave up on
it. Oh, man, yeah. What a dream crusher.
He completely crushed me. And
that's what they're there to do, though.
But you know, the one thing, and I didn't admire this until later, or appreciate it, I should say, the military gave me so much appreciation for the survival mindset. I really learned and understood how they were giving us these skills to be more aware and how to conduct ourselves in situations where anything could go wrong. And I was just like, wow, when I'm teaching these survival classes, especially the psychology of survival to my students, I realized a lot of the stuff I was talking about had been taught to me in the military. And it was just upon reflection that I remembered all that. And I was like, man, that's really cool that I got all that stuff, because it was deeply ingrained in me when I started teaching these classes. And but yeah, I was very jaded, by the way, in the military. Definitely went about it. The only way you really get to do all that stuff is if you join some sort of special ops branch where you're going behind enemy lines, and it's imperative that you learn the skills to be able to just barely survive, to get out of there and get back to some sort of supply train and back to your people who are going to take care of you. Yeah. They very much at this point have made it you a self-reliant cog in the wheel as far as the military goes. And not to say there isn't a lot of cool things to learn there. It's just, it's very much a machine now where it's driven by so many different things that help everybody out. Whereas I feel like when you go back to Vietnam and World War II, you had guys who were going out into the field and they had to know how to survive,
right,
and know these basic skills. Right. Otherwise, they were screwed, because
right,
the supply networks were terrible. They didn't have airplanes and vehicles that can go over long terrain and the ability to create safe corridors for all this stuff to be transported to you. So it's like, you got to figure it out yourself. And that's just not the case today. It's totally different.
Yeah. Unless you're that behind the enemy lines.
Right. But I will also say it's what makes our military so deadly, is that we have figured out how to get our troops to not be relying on
logistics.
That. Yeah. And so now, not having to focus on survival skills, let's focus your skills on being efficient killers. Let's make you so that you can get in there and just destroy everything as quickly as possible.
Right.
And I think it's a brilliant technique that we've developed over time, starting with like the Romans and the Macedonians and all those people. Yeah, it's insane what we've created.
We were just talking about that earlier, like Roman emperors and stuff earlier today. It's like, it's funny, it's getting brought up again. So you, when you were in the military, did you get to go anywhere on, again, going back to this adventure concept we've been talking about, like that you would perceive as adventure? Or were you like, oh,
not
here's Iraq,
really,
or here's Syria, or here's, did you get deployed?
I did get put into many, I got to go all over the place. I, as far as adventure, not really, because
but
can't
you
can't explore.
Like,
you can't like go out and
like leave base.
Yeah, you can't leave base. You got to stay, you got to do everything you're told to do. It's very regimented to the point where if you go outside of the norm of what they're trying to have you to do, you are often ostracized and labeled as a troublemaker.
Sure.
And so as far as adventure goes, no, I felt it was very much suppressed, my sense of adventure. And I felt very much like I was trapped in this cage. And the bureaucracy and red tape in the military was just so suffocating. I mean, we have something called an EAS counter, where EASing is when you're getting out of the military. It's like your final thing you do. And I remember I downloaded this app that was counting down down to the second how long I had until I got out of the military. And yeah, that was what my mentality was. I was very jaded. It was not what I expected. Even my recruiters lied to me, which is a very common thing to try and get people to join the military. I mean, they're like, you're going to travel around the whole world. You're having these crazy adventures, go all this amazing training. You're going to get to fight people on every continent. You're going to get to have sex with women from all over the place. And I was like, that's awesome. Like, yes, sign me up. Let me be Indiana Jones in real life. And it's just not the reality.
Wow.
I mean, one of the greatest skills I ever learned was how to clean my room, like really efficiently. Like, I got real good at cleaning stuff.
Did you bounce quarters off your sheets?
I mean, we had these things called white glove inspections.
Oh, wow.
And they would just come in with a white glove, literally, and just, like, sweep every surface. And if you screwed up, oh, you never heard the end of it. I mean, you were destroyed for it. And so, yeah, I got really good at being very disciplined and impeccably clean. So, I mean, that was a good thing, I guess. But
yeah.
But it wasn't did what you, I was looking for.
Did you do 4 years, 6 years?
How yeah, long? I did a four-year contract. Four-year. Yeah. And as soon as it was over, I remember I handed in my ID card, and I stepped out of the base, and I just was like, now what?
Yeah.
And at that point, again, my sense of adventure had been suppressed so much in my passions, and I was just like, I don't know what to do with myself. And so I spent maybe like a year just trying to figure that out and just not knowing what route I needed to take in life. And the only thing that came to my mind at that point was a reality check of I need money. So I started doing security jobs because it was the only thing that I was really highly qualified for was doing security. And then I decided, screw it. I'm just going to use my GI Bill and go to college. And I just watched Indiana Jones too. So I was like, oh, like maybe archaeology is the way to feed that bug.
Yes.
And I loved ancient human culture. It's amazing and fascinating. And going back to like conspiracy theories, thinking about like how did the pyramids get made? Like
oh,
who
yeah.
did all this stuff? Ancient aliens. I was like, I want to be the archaeologist that figures all that stuff
out.
Oh,
yeah.
So I started learning archaeology at Suffolk County Community College. And it was cool, but I didn't like how colleges forced classes on you. And I was just like, I hate statistics. I hated math so much. And I know it's a useful thing. It's like the language of the universe, but it was just not for me. And there were other classes I was taking, like art and I was just like, I don't really, like, this is cool, and I know it adds to my being as a human, but it's not scratching that itch, and I don't quite understand how to do it. And when you're first learning archaeology, you're not in the field. You're not doing all the cool stuff. I mean, we went to a couple of dig sites where we watched archaeologists doing their job, and we got to dig a little bit and look for things, but it was just, it wasn't the same. I was in a hole with a little tiny trowel taking away inches of earth until I found something, and it was very slow, and it just wasn't the adventure I was looking for. So I was like, all right, and archaeology was still the only thing that came close to my mind reaching that adventure. And I was like, what can I do to make this work? And then I thought, what if I go to South America and I just learn and find all the stuff on my own, and then I sell the information to a university. I clearly had no idea how this stuff worked. Like, because that's not what happens.
Yeah, there's all these organizations who are going to stop you from doing
that. Oh, I would have been labeled, what do they call, a grave digger or a tomb raider. That's what I would have become, and I would have gotten in so much trouble.
There's probably a lot of money in the black markets for that.
Oh, for sure. I mean,
it's awful. Just kidding, y'all.
That's where I could have made my big bucks. But also, I realized I wasn't going to be able to do those cool expeditions unless I got like a master's or a PhD. You can't. As a bachelor's or an associate's degree, you're not taken seriously and you're not given those cool leadership positions and the entitlement to be able to do those cool expeditions. And so I thought to myself, I'll stop going to college now because I feel like I've learned enough about the basics of archaeology. And I'm going to go to a survival school for like a weekend or a week and master the skills. And then I'll go to South America and I'll do it. I'll just find all the ancient temples. And again, I was still in that period of confusion where I had this idea that I could master all these skills in a weekend. That's how little I really knew about wilderness survival and just naturalist skills in general. And so I just typed in GI Bill friendly survival school. And the first thing that popped up was Alderleaf Wilderness College. And I was like,
nice. Was awesome.
Like, whoa, they got a year-long program? Like, I'd never heard of anything like that. I was like, after a year, I will be the greatest survival expert to ever live. Like, I'll be better than Les Stroud.
Right.
I was like, boom, sign me up. And I sold all my things. I got rid of my car. I sold my kayak. And I just...
Where'd you live when you were up there in Washington?
So I was living... when I went to Washington, I flew over there, and I was living in Snohomish County in this place called Monroe. Have you ever heard of Monroe?
Yeah.
So I was in this place called Monroe, and I was in student housing. So Jason Knight, the owner of Alderleaf, he had maybe like two or three housing options for students that were flying in from different places.
Whoa, dude, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was super cool. And I was
gotta
like,
look
great.
Into that. That's cool.
So I signed up for this place called the Tuwako River House, and it was right on the, I think I want to say it was the Skykomish River. And when I first got there, I was probably a month ahead of time because I wanted some time before the classes actually started. And my roommates were former graduates of the first year program. And so I was like, cool, like maybe I can learn something from these guys. And one of them was going to be an apprentice, so an assistant instructor for my group. And so I was like, sweet, I'm going to get the jump start on this. But the shitty thing was that they wouldn't tell me anything. They're like, no, we have to let you experience for the first time with them. Like, yeah. We can't tell you anything. I was like, you guys suck. So I started just like bow drilling on my own and doing stuff by myself. But one of the things that became very clear to me was I was scared of the wilderness. And it was hard to me to admit to myself because I was like, I'm some badass Marine. How am I scared to go into the woods? But every time I tried to go to the river, there was probably a patch of woods that was maybe a couple hundred meters thick. And it was maybe in length like a mile long. So it was probably about 4 or 5 acres of wilderness between me and the river. And every time I tried to go in there, I got too scared. I was like, there's cougars, bears, bobcats. This thing's just going to eat me and kill me. And so I was just like, I can't go in there. I don't know what to do. And so the only times I did go down to the river was when he went down to the river. So I'd be like, all right, he knows what he's doing. I'm just going to follow him down there and hitch a ride with this guy. And but I never told him that's why I was doing it.
That's awesome.
Because it was embarrassing. I was like, sure. Like, but also I didn't know anything about animal behavior. I just saw everything wanted to eat me. I just felt like a defenseless primate out in this terrifyingly foreign, huge jungle. And so it's funny because probably about 2 weeks before I started survival school at Alderleaf, I had my first wilderness survival experience where I was trying to swim across the river, and the river is probably about maybe 60 or 70 yards across. So it's a good distance, good swimming distance. And on the other side, the water was increasing in speed because of the bend. And there is this beautiful, small white boat floating down the river. And I saw it, and I was like, oh, there's no one in it. Like, that's a free boat. I'm going to go across and get it. And the guy who was with me, him and another person who was going to be an apprentice, they were kind of like boyfriend, girlfriend, on and off. So they were just paying attention to each other. So I was just like the third wheel. I was like, I'm going to go get that boat. And so while they were doing their thing, I jumped in the water and not thinking about it, I swam all the way across against the current and got to the boat.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. So when I got in there, I pulled myself in. I had no energy left. And I realized why it was abandoned. There was a freaking huge hole in it. And as soon as my weight was in there, it just started gushing full of water. So I had maybe a split second to make a decision of what I was going to do next. Because I knew if I stayed in the boat, it was going to keep carrying me and eventually sink. And then I'd end up in a place where I didn't know the location. Like, I was brand new to Washington. I didn't know where the hell I was. And again, I was scared of the woods. I knew I'd be plunged into the wilderness. And so I jumped out. I was like, I'll just swim back to the exact spot that I left. And about halfway across, my muscles cramped up and seized, and I physically couldn't move my arms anymore. And I felt my head going under, and I was like, holy shit, like, I'm about to drown. And it became a reality, like, death is really about to hit me. And for a split second, I had this immense panic just course in my body of like, no, I'm too young to die. Like, this is insane. And then I had as my head was going under and I realized there was nothing I could do, I accepted it for a split second. I was just like, all right, I guess I'm going to die. And that was a terrifying feeling. And then something just clicked. And I remembered in the Marine Corps when I was going through swim training, they taught us how to deal with drowning situations. And I was like, oh, yeah, I need to get down to the bottom. Now, this is something you do in like static water that's not flowing. But I tried it anyway. And what I did was I let all my air out and I forced myself down to the bottom of the water. And when I got down there, I power squatted my way back up and I was able to get a gulp of air. And I just kept going down, power squatting until I got to the edge and I could stand up and I collapsed on the bank. And my friend ran over. He was like, are you okay? And I was like, no. And that was all I could say. I was so out of breath. I was just dying. And I was like, holy shit, I almost died. And my body was so exhausted. I laid there for at least an hour. I just physically couldn't move, and the adrenaline was pumping through me. And then finally, when I sat up, I was like, oh my God, I almost died 2 weeks before going to a wilderness survival school. Like, how embarrassing would that would have been? So I didn't tell anybody about it, although I assume he probably let some people know about what happened.
Oh my God.
But that was the first time I had a real survival experience as far as the wilderness goes. And I was just like, damn, I need to learn more because there was a lot of mistakes I made there.
Yeah.
And I think, again, going back to it, the military gave me that survival mentality of not giving up because, again, I had that brief moment of just accepting it because I thought there were no options, and I was just like, no, like, I can't die. This is ridiculous. I'm just going to figure this out, and then I made it, and it was just like, cool.
Wow.
It can be done. I had no survival skills, and it could be done. So that was a really big eye-opener for me was that first year.
Dude, that was an awesome story, man. That's definitely what I think a lot of folks go through is that fight, flight, freeze, you know, moment. And it felt like you did all three.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The whole motion.
Just like, well, here we go. Let's just try all of them and see which one works the best for me. But that's good that I personally think all animals, you know, just the amount that I've seen, animals basically don't like, you go hunt bison, they're not like, hell yeah, here, let shoot me in the side. But you're like, you get near it, and it's like, pew, you know?
Yeah, or it's like, get the hell away from me.
Right.
It'll run you down.
Right. And so I think we all have the desire and will to survive, and it's just that moment for us. Like, mm-hmm. We get to kind of decide, like, meh, it's okay, you know? And I think, what if that happens to a lot of people? What if they literally in their last thought was like, well, I guess this is death, and
I think that's what's unique about humans, is I feel we're, and I can't say this as a definitive because we don't know what animals are thinking, but
right.
I feel like a major difference between us and animals is we have this amazing ability to self-wallow and just, like, allow ourselves to spiral into a depression,
yes.
In which case we will just Agreed. Allow ourselves to die, which is insane that we developed that.
Yeah, I've never watched a dog, like, with a sticker burr in his foot be like, I'm helpless.
Yeah,
they just keep running on, and they're just like, pick their paw, and then they run with three legs. And I'm like
you see,
bro, he's still got a smile on his face, and he's chasing the ball with a sticker.
Yeah,
his
you ever see those like videos on Instagram or something where it's like African animals with like a missing leg, or it's just that like eviscerated, and its organs are pouring out, and it's still just going through its daily day. Humans can't, like, we can, but I feel like it's a lot harder for us to accept that reality.
Yeah, it takes a different type of human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I think one that we don't see today because we haven't met that amount of conflict or, you know, adversity. But I don't want to speak for everybody because there's a world of people out there who are probably facing that exact adversity every day of their lives.
Yeah.
So I'm just telling y'all that I haven't. I don't face those adversities. So you went through the military and you decided, all right, Alderleaf is where it's at. Now, you spent 9 months or 1 year, 11 months. How long did you spend up there? You said it was pretty long.
So I did the first year program, and my intention was to be an archaeologist. I still had no intention of being an educator or being in the outdoor field at all. As far as like teaching goes, I definitely wanted to be outdoors. It wasn't until we had our first field trip. You ever been to the Oregon Dunes before?
No.
It's amazing. You got to check it out. It's what I imagined the Sahara Desert looked like. Because I had never seen the Sahara before.
It's like Monahans.
Yeah, it's just like Monahans.
Okay, I've been to Monahans a bunch.
But the only difference between Monahans and the Oregon Dunes is that there are, in Monahans, you have a lot of vegetation kind of covering smaller, like lower areas and just kind of sprawl throughout. With the Oregon Dunes, it's very much a dune sea where, and at the top of these really tall dunes are tree islands. And so it's almost like islands throughout a sea of sand, and it's super cool. And it's where the inspiration for the movie Dune came from. The guy who wrote the book was at the Oregon Dunes when he did that, which is crazy cool. But I remember my mentor, Chris Bird, probably the most intelligent human I'd ever met. He was what I began to believe a naturalist should be. He was the standard for me, like the gold standard. He was, well, when we got there as a class, there was about 30 of us, and the whole point was for the whole week, we'd be going out with random instructors, whoever we chose to go with, and we would be learning about the ecology and some survival skills along the way. And at this point, I had gotten to do a couple of classes with Chris, and I immediately found him to be intriguing because he was like a walking encyclopedia. And any question I had, he could answer. And I was just enthralled by that. I was like, okay, cool. When we go on these adventures, I'm going to choose Chris as my group leader and go with him. And a few people chose, so there's probably like three or four of us that went with Chris, and he promised us we wouldn't be walking very far, and that we'd be pretty much be staying in a localized area and just learning a ton of stuff. And I was like, okay, we'll see how much he actually knows about this. And he was true to his word. He'd look at a bush and just give us its entire natural history. And it was too much information for my brain to download. I was just like, the whole time I felt like just a pile of mush walking through the dunes with him. But it was so cool. And I was like, holy crap, this is what I want to do. Like, I want to be a naturalist. And I want to be like Chris. I want to know all these amazing things and be able to share that with others and give them the same effect that I'm having right now of just this sense of wonder. And I remember at the end of the day, we got to the very tallest of the dunes, which was also like the entrance to the camping area. And I was just standing there looking out across the dunes out to the Pacific Sea. And I just had this revelation of, all right, I can't be an archaeologist anymore. I have to be a naturalist. And that's when I went from that period of confusion to just wanderlust. And I was like, the world is amazing, and I can't believe I've been blind this whole time. Like, it was just a veil was lifted, and I could see everything differently for the first time. And that's when all of it really changed for me. That was the moment when I decided to be a naturalist.
You know? Man. You know, that's beautiful. I tell people that all the time. I'm like, listen, don't learn survival skills.
Yeah.
Because I was about to ask you a question, which is, if you had to redo it all over again, would you do it that same way? Would you go through the military? Would you go through the Alderleaf? Would you then, you know, want
that's
to be?
That's a good question.
Or would,
I think,
now that you're there, would you do it in a different way? Because that's, if I had to redo this whole thing, I would say I wish I would have started with the naturalist studies. Because,
oh, really?
Yeah, of course. Because you're, as a survivalist, you're going to hit a wall.
Yeah.
Which is trees.
Right.
Boom.
The wall
there's
is
the wall.
You have to learn about the naturalist stuff. Yeah.
Literally and figuratively. And, you know, you do not know what's in front of you.
Yeah.
And you're
no, going
to walk right into it. And I think if you study to be a naturalist, then again, I always tell people, you don't need to know how to build forts or shelters
right.
or whatever. You just go wherever the deer are when it's pouring and cold outside because they are not just hanging out in the rain all the time like
right,
that.
Right, that's miserable.
That's miserable.
They're
and
mammals
you,
just like us.
If you study where they hang out, you will find that there are these big old patches of just dry grass with
yeah.
tree canopy, and you'll be like, whoa, this probably has just got through a downpour, and it is bone dry and warm in here. And
right,
it's like,
yeah,
that's where you need to go. You don't need to know. So I tell people all the time, do the naturalist route. So if you're listening to this podcast for the first time, don't start. You can go to Winter Count and go to survival schools all you want, but study the insects, study the hydrogeology, the geology, because that makes up all the everything, soils, you know, study there.
Oh,
and
yeah. Geology is amazing.
It will lay such a beautiful foundation for all your survival needs, I promise you. And so, yeah, if you did it over again, would you redo it?
I have to say probably it's a yes and no answer. Yes, I would. If I could start it all over again, I would do it through tracking.
Yeah, that's mastery
yeah,
of awareness
think,
and naturalist studies.
Yeah,
right there.
I think tracking
perfect.
Has just been like, when I first started tracking, it was like sorcery to me. And I was like, whoa, this is cool. And it was just amazing to be able to start seeing the world in a totally different view and picking up on patterns and then finally actually putting a story to what I was seeing. And I think that was very captivating. It has always been, it still is for me. But I think I would still also want to be drawn in through the survival skills only because it's what I was interested in. I think if I had started out with like trees and learning all the natural sciences, I don't think I would have been as enthralled as I was.
Sure.
When I was watching Survivor Man, I was like, whoa, he just caught a rabbit with a snare. Like that was cool. I think the excitement and the charismatic part of survival was the survival skills themselves, and that's what drew me in. And then understanding later that The only way I would get better at these skills was if I did natural sciences. That's what drew me in to start learning about the natural sciences more deeply for me.
Yeah. You know, honestly, I bet the majority of people, that's exactly what happened, was you have to have that, like, diving board approach.
Yeah.
You're like, all right, this is fun. Boring? And you just spring right into it. But the diving board was what was enticing.
Yeah,
right? It's like exactly. Going to the pool. It's like, this is like, pool's cool.
Bounce on this shit. That's cool.
Bounce. Yeah, let's do that. And then you're like, okay, wait, you can do tricks on this sucker. And you're like, sweet. So then you go to the trampoline in your backyard. You go to gymnastics classes. And you're like, I would have never been into gymnastics. What am I doing? You get to do yoga to get balance or whatever. You know, it's weird how we get sucked into the things that we do via the initial excitement factor, you know, and for you, it was the survival. So it brought you to the world of the naturalist. And it did that to me. So maybe I'm sitting here talking nonsense, but if I had to redo it again, I would have done, like you said, I'd start with tracking and understanding what all these things were. Because I think it's fine. The ethnobotany portion is perfectly fine. You could say, all right, this tree is a pecan. You know, it's a state tree of Texas. But check this out. This is kind of fascinating. You can take these leaves because they have these saponins in them and in small pools of water. If you can kind of, you know, use a weir to get fish in there, you can throw these leaves in there and it'll stun the fish and just scoop them out with a net. Like, how easy is that for survival? And you're like, okay, you got me.
Right. And I think that's the point is like when I started learning ethnobotany and natural sciences, what drew me in was its application to the skills that was able, like, when I tried learning trees, I was like, well, how do I remember the alder leaf? Oh, it's great for cooking utensils. It's an amazing cooking utensil tree because it doesn't give off any sort of odor or taste or anything. It's easy to carve. And I was like, great, perfect. And it's really good cooking wood. Or just like bow woods. That's how I started getting into like vine maples and junipers. And I was just like, oh, I can make bows out of these. And that helped me start to remember the trees more efficiently. It was when I knew how could I use it for my own use.
That's
purposes.
Right. Yeah. And that's what we all need. We all as humans, like every one of us, I don't care. Black, white, Asian, religion, where you're from, whatever. You are a human and first and foremost. And therefore you need what I think grandfather, he referred to as pure eternal truths, right? We're talking about Tom Brown, grandfather, you know, the thing that united us all, which was community, you know, clothing, food, shelter, like all these things. And once we meet those needs for ourselves, then this world kind of like opens up and you begin going and exploring it in a whole new way. We're almost like, I don't know, you're boundless in a way. Because now you're like, well, I could go out to the middle of nowhere and, you know, still be fine because I still just need to meet these key factors. Like, how do I thermoregulate my body? How do I stay hydrated? Like, because that's it. That's all it takes.
It's that sense of empowerment. You're just like, I can do anything now.
Anything. And it's fun and it's very liberating. So when we talk about freedom, you know, wanting to be free, that's free to me, is alleviating yourself from the grocery stores or whatever. Like, hey, I know how to make my own medicine from the plantain and the yarrow and yucca and soaps and all these things. Like, that's just so liberating. And so what, in your endeavors, through all these adventures, you got through a year of alder leaf. What would you say was your favorite skill? And you can't say
two skills.
You can't say tracking. Tracking can't be one because I know that already.
All right. Well, we all know tracking. It's like the number one. But if it had to be like hard skills where I'm physically making the stuff, it's probably fire and stone tools. And I think it's fire because it's so humbling. It took me 3 months to get my first bow drill fire. We did bow drill our second week at Alderleaf, and I couldn't do it. And I was getting frustrated. I started getting annoyed with the instructors because I was like, you guys are supposed to be professionals and I can't do it. Like, what the hell's wrong with y'all?
They weren't helping. They were just asking questions.
Well, I think it was partly that. And I think also a lot of the instructors were former students. And I don't think they had dove into understanding how to diagnose kits themselves. And so when I ran into a problem, I think often they didn't really know how to fix that problem, because they had never tried to do it themselves. And so I think I was just running into issues they'd never worked with before, and I was just having to figure it out myself. And so I struggled, and I feel like at least 80% of my class got a bow drill coal that first day, and I was just so demoralized that every day I started working on it. And I kept running into issue after issue after issue, and I was just like, maybe I just really suck at this, and it's just not for me.
No, it's because you were destined to be a teacher of it all, man.
Maybe.
Were you journaling a lot during this?
I was
failures?
Journaling a yeah? lot, yeah. That's I was good. Always trying to figure out what I did and then seeing if I replicated it, did something new happen or not. And
the dust is brown.
Yeah, that's how I learned. I started like learning like, okay, if I do this, then it's going to slip out of the notch. Uh-huh. Or if I make the notch too big, what's going to happen? I just started figuring all these little things out that can go wrong. And then it was probably... We went down to the river one day. We took a van ride down to the river, and the goal that day was to do a friction fire off the land without a knife. And I was like, I'm not going to succeed. I haven't even gotten it when you guys gave me a knife and all the perfect materials for it that you harvested. So how the hell am I going to pull this off? And so I was already frustrated going off in the bat.
Oh, gosh.
But I loved stone tools. And so when we got down to the river, I was like, screw it. The first thing I'm going to do is just make a stone tool. So I made the entire stone tool kit I thought I would need to make, my bow drill kit. And I, again, Chris was someone who started captivating me into really wanting to learn natural sciences. And so I was really starting to try and figure out how to find dry wood and what species were good for that. So I found the right materials for it. And then... I went ahead and just made a wild kit, and I, after 3 months, I did all the things I had figured out to make it better, and it all just worked in that one moment. It clicked.
Oh, man.
And I got a frictionless fire out the land, and I was one of the first people to get it, and I was like, holy shit, I did it.
Dude, that is amazing, James.
Yeah, and it's funny, because I remember the moment when I was in the zone, I knew it. I knew I was going to get the coal because I was like, everything feels right. And I didn't know how I knew it felt right, but I just did. And I was like, I'm going to get the coal. And then I saw that smoke wisping up. I was like, holy shit, I did it. Like,
what were y'all using as string? Ones.
So for that, I used cedar rootlets for string. I had used a cottonwood root as my board.
Nice.
And I used a cottonwood spindle that I had gotten from a dead branch. And for a bow, I think I used a vine maple because they had shown us to use vine maple first. And so I was like, great, there it is. Yeah. I know how to use this thing. And for stone tools, I was using the basalt. There's just basalt everywhere. And I already understood flint knapping to a degree. I wasn't good at it. And I could tell you a story about flint knapping, how much I hated it at first. But
Discoidal blades.
Oh, God.
Easily from the beach.
Terrible words. But I made the tools and... They were so sharp, and I remember I was like, wow, like why don't we still use stones anymore? This stuff is easily accessible and is as sharp as a knife. Like I understand it breaks down more easily, but it's just super charismatic too. And yeah, when I made that kit and I got the fire, I was just blown away. So I think the intensity and humbleness of trying to make fire is what draws me to that skill. And then stone tools, I feel like when I was going to college, I was doing archaeology. I was also taking geology courses, and I was blown away by how the geology of the earth has shaped humans. I mean, everything we have today is thanks to the geology of the planet.
It. Correct.
It's insane. And when I first learned flint knapping, it was this guy named Russ. He was one of the instructors, and he had just finished his second year at Alderleaf, so he was made an instructor because Jason was pulling people from his programs, which is a smart thing to do. And Russ was pretty good at flint knapping. He struggled in teaching it, though. And so I wasn't getting the concepts very well. And so I was just hitting a rock. That's all I was doing. I was like, this is it. This is all I know how to do is hit this stupid rock and hope that, God, that something happens. And so I kept getting frustrated with it. And I remember I went down to the river one day when I finally gained the confidence to do it on my own. And I picked up this piece of rock that I thought was basalt. But now I realized after I had started doing my own tests, I realized it was slate. And I just rubbed it on another rock, and I saw a little bit come off. And I was like, ooh, why don't we just, like, grind it?
Yeah.
And so I started grinding the rock, and I made a beautiful knife. And I was like, why the hell am I learning flint knapping when I could just do it this way?
It doesn't work like that everywhere.
And I'd never heard of grinding before. I didn't know it existed. And I didn't even learn it when I was doing archaeology because they mostly focus on, like, flakes and stuff like that at archaeological sites, at least what I was learning when I was doing it. And I came up to Chris, and I was like, you're not going to believe this. But I just discovered a new way to make stone tools. And he was like, what? And I was like, grinding. And I showed him how I did it. And he was like, oh, yeah, that's been around for like 9,000 years. I was like, damn it, really? I thought I was an innovator.
No, but, you were being a child.
Yeah,
you were
being a curious.
Child. And when I say child, I mean like that in the positive sense, obviously. Like you had your inner instincts activate while in that moment of like, what would happen if?
Yeah.
You know, and that's the best way to be an educator or to learn these skills is to have those natural curiosities. Because when we're taught, here's how to make a fire, we're just instantly myopically focused in that's how you make a fire.
Right, when there's a million different ways right. to do it.
So yeah. I would imagine that simultaneously the Alderley staff are such professionals that they never actually guided you because they felt within the vein of what you earn, you learn.
Right, right. Yeah.
So they were like,
I would agree with that, yeah.
We're not going to help him. He needs to learn this and yeah. then he'll learn it. You know, and I really struggle with that too, but hats off to those teachers who have enough patience and more importantly, hats off to those students who have the patience to pay such an amount of money to go yeah. to somewhere where you're kind of, I was like that too. One time, Tom Brown, like, I was like, Tom, I was like, what? It's like, what kind of knots do you like to put in this bow drill kit? I was like, cause I would imagine that there's probably half a dozen or so that you would
yeah, easily,
like,
yeah.
right? Like the Quinn knot that we all used at Earth Native, like best fucking thing in the world.
Oh, I still
but
use
like,
that. Yeah.
I still use it. But like, he didn't tell me that. He goes, I don't know. He goes, just figure out some knots and throw them in there. And I was like, are you this mother effer serious? He didn't yeah. answer my question. How much money did I pay to come hang out with this dude? He's just not going to tell me. But now I'm like, yeah, I'm glad he didn't tell me because I legit went and got one of his knot books off the thing and started looking yeah. around. And I think when he talks about that's how grandfather was, like that is how he was because he right. still does that, you know? And so I'm hopeful that we as educators can continue to impart that with the passionate curiosity that you had in that moment to pick up that slate rock and be like, I'm going to grind this against another rock. I just invented this. Y'all check yeah. it out.
I think it's a hard thing to master too. I feel like a lot of teachers are used to the idea of being the center of attention and being the leader where they have to give all the knowledge to a student. And I had the same frustrations when I went to Alderleaf and we did sit spots. I was like, this is dumb. Oh. I didn't pay $14,000 so right. I can sit in the middle of the woods and just listen to someone snoring over there. Yeah, I could just go in the woods by myself. Like, it's not what I signed up for. And I felt that way for years until I realized one day, like, oh, that was a learning process. And they were just facilitating and giving me the tools to do it. And I think that was a huge turning point for me too, is when I realized what was actually going on in the background. And Chris Bird, man, he was so good at facilitating those kinds of things. And yeah, I remember my very first sit spot. I sat there and I was like, this is dumb. And my buddy Eric, he wasn't my friend at the time yet, but he was probably about 40 feet away and he just fell asleep instantly. He was snoring. And I was like,
relaxing.
This is why we don't do this. This is stupid. And when I went to Wilderness Awareness School, I still had that mindset quite a bit. And they were way harder on those kind of teaching methods.
Yeah.
And I remember one day we just wandered around the woods. And I was just like, why'd we do that? Like, why didn't y'all teach us, like, hard skills and ways we can actually survive? And now reflecting upon it, I was like, man, they were doing such a good job teaching me. Because I really was. I remember when we were wandering, I was like, screw this. I'm going to teach myself then. So I started, like, looking for invertebrates, and I started looking for bird's nests. And I was like, I would have done that if they didn't give me the freedom to
exactly.
do it. And so, yeah, it's...
Yeah, that's
so cool.
Boredom, right? Because that's what it is. We are the culture of give me, give me, give me, give me, give me, whether it's information, whether it's entertainment, whether it's, you know, whatever, you name it. We are that demanding culture. And so when we pay something, right, that's our hard-earned money, we expect something. And
right,
it's those
yeah.
expectations that unfortunately are killers. And I'll never forget. I wrote down almost every word. And in fact, I recorded it while I was there. But Tom Brown Jr.'s son, T3, you know, he had this talk like right away. Sunday night, the lecture, Tom Brown got up there, he gave it. But the next morning, Monday morning, T3 got up there and talked about expectations.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget what he said. He goes, they're just such killers. And he gave this this example, and it was so beautiful. I'm going to use this little glass right here in front of me, but he goes, let's pretend that this is your vessel. He's like, and you come out here and you have a moment with a butterfly. He goes, and it fills the vessel up. He goes, and then you have a moment with a bird, and then, you know, and all these things keep happening. He goes, and it's filling it up. He goes, but if you come out here and your vessel is so large because you own a Porsche and you own a billion-dollar business and you've had every extravagant thing in the world. He goes, those moments of that interaction with the butterfly, He's like, they might not fill your vessel.
Yeah.
He goes, so this week we're asking you to empty your vessel. He goes, it might be big. He goes, it might be tiny. He's like, but if you just get to emptying it, he goes, at least when something goes in, he's like, even if it's tiny in amount, he's like, it'll still have meaning to you.
That's cool. I like that you said that.
And I was just, I'll never forget that. That was it. Because you got to set the stage for your audience.
Yeah.
When you're going to be with a group of folks out in the woods for a week long, you've got to let them know about expectations. And I want to say, like, I am 100% still guilty. I have gone to wilderness classes recently and had expectations for myself. And I had to remind myself, hey, like, even at the very end of the trip, I was like, dang, I totally let expectations get in the way because I was expecting this. You know, but you also are thought like, well, that's what was sold to me, right? But if I'd have just put those back, stifled those feelings, I think I would have had a much better experience. And so I'm always telling folks to like stifle those expectations in that moment. So, but that's great that you were able to utilize the freedom to go explore invertebrates and make connections and do all those things. That one was at WAS or was that at Alderleaf?
Yeah, that was at, well, I mean, it happened a lot at Alderleaf too. Yeah. But it was that particular story was at WAS, yeah.
But it's funny because we look at the 13 core routines of nature connection, right? And it says on there, wandering.
Yeah.
And you're like, dang it. I didn't know that in the beginning.
I had flipped through the Coyote book at that point, but I never really read it or took anything to meaning.
It's those core principles, man, if you can just form your whole everything on like life, just enjoying happiness, you can use those 13.
Oh, absolutely.
Sit in the woods. Yeah. And yeah, I will say about the sit spot thing, I think every person in the world feels exactly the way you did the moment that you sit in the woods like that. I did that with a group of homeschoolers one time, and they just thought I was the craziest person in the world. They're like, why did you make the kids sit for 15 minutes in the woods? I
was
like, what do you mean? I was like, it's part of what we do. And they're like, this is just it's like dead air. I was like, no, it's not. I was like, there's things, you go out there and you trounce and there's a baseline that gets disrupted and then you sit for 20 minutes and it goes back to normal and then things start
happening.
That's
when the cool stuff happens,
It's when the weasels come up on the rocks and hang out with you, man. You don't even know. Yeah, it's exactly what happens. So, well, we're getting on to an hour here on this podcast, and I know that I could go for another hour, but I hope that at some point you'll come back on and we can chat more. But I'm just curious if you'd like to tell us a little bit about, like, we talked, I was going to say, tell us a little bit about what would you share with somebody who's going to get into these skills? But we kind of talked a little bit about that, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
And so I'm curious, have you ever had any, let's just wrap it up on this. Have you ever had, you've been a teacher now of these skills. Have you ever had any like insane things happen to you while teaching? Like, that's, this is a disaster.
As far as like disasters, I've witnessed disasters.
Oh, while in a class or
I'm someone who's very meticulous in how I do things. And I'm also very adaptable. And so I have found that I don't often run into disasters. Although one little thing that happened once was we were doing a teen overnight, and one of the kids made the fire too big, and there was still a lot of tall grass around, and the wind picked up, and some of the grass caught on fire, and it was going fast. And he immediately started freaking out, and all the other teens started freaking out. And I was just like, oh, don't worry about it, guys. And I just like grabbed a jug of water and then poured it. I poured it at the edges of it to create a perimeter, and then I just stamped it out. And they're like, how did you do that? Like, weren't you worried about like a forest fire happening? I was like, yeah, but it's just like, if you don't stay calm, then that's just going to make it way worse. And that's probably like the craziest thing that happened to me as far as like things possibly going wrong. But I remember one time we were doing something called Fire Quest, where the kids go on the rite of passage for, going from, I think, what we would call the Coyote program. So they're about to turn 12 and go into the teen program. And what they would have to do is they'd stay out in the wilderness, and they had to build a fire by themselves, create their own campsite, and stay there and maintain the fire until the morning. And then there was a ceremony. And while we were doing that, this other team of instructors was running a teen program, and the teens were doing something that we called Earth Quest, where it was basically just a vision quest, but we called it Earth Quest. And it was for 72 hours, and this crazy storm hit, And in order to get to the teenagers, you had to cross this creek. And the creek was rising fast. And I remember this instructor, he decided that he was going to cross it with the teens. And I remember thinking, that could have gone so poorly. There's other, like, and there was a road that led there too. So I was like, why didn't you just call someone and say, hey, we're going to hang out here and hunker down. Just grab us when you can with the van or something. And I remember thinking, yeah, that was a terrible decision. And lots of little things happened throughout my career with that, where just people would make decisions where I was like, that could have gone terribly wrong. And we're really lucky that it didn't. And so I feel like those are the main stories I end up coming back with, is like, damn, I'm glad nothing really bad happened when you did that.
Yeah, man, I have those exact same stories, both of those. We were building debris huts with a group of, it was a 2.5 week, 14 days, I guess. We had 14 days and a couple days of training before, but 2 week excursion on land outside of Bulverde, Texas here. And one of the students who was a teacher, he was a professor, actually. That's why I say that. My bad. One of the students built a shelter, told me how terrified he was of bugs. I explained to him this smudge thing you could do. I told him, don't go crazy, man. Like, you just want smoke. You don't want no flames, nothing like that.
Yeah, right.
Well, he decided it would be good to get an agave stock, which the inside is pithy, soft, hollow, you know. And he got it smoky, and it was fine. But it caught a draft. I mean, and so it ignited. So it got a little bit of a wind, but he had just set it inside, like a cup inside your debris shelter.
Yeah.
Right? And it poof. And all of a sudden, like, I was in the process of helping this kid. We had caught a rabbit, and we were cleaning the rabbit. And I just remember, like, looking over and hearing this, like, ah! And, like, I just look over, and there's, like, flames, like a column, like a straight 30-foot column of flames just shooting out of this forest. And I was like, oh, my God. And I had a couple of apprentices and, like, interns and volunteers. And I just remember running over there, and I just yelled at everybody. I was like, make a break. And they were like, what? And I just pushed everything towards that inferno. Yeah. And they were like, why would you do that? And I was like, make a break. I was like, don't stand there and stare at me while I do this. And I just started pushing everything towards us. Meanwhile, Jake's over there, the intern, getting the hose. And it went up. That debris hut went up in flames. And then a wind gust caught it, threw a spark on Laura's. Hers went up in flames.
Yeah.
Cooked one of these trees. And they were doing a medicinal plant class at the time about burns with prickly pear, and I go in there, and the owner of the school's like, and I was like thinking to myself, like, oh, they just hired me, like, now they're gonna fire me. Like, I walk in and they're doing this thing on burns, and he's like, what happened? I was like, oh my God, the woods almost burnt down, dude. And he's like, you all right? I was like, yeah, my face is kind of torched. And I was like, you know, you're next to a debris head that goes up in flames. It's like getting next to a bonfire. Yeah,
it's a giant tinder bundle you're making.
It's huge. And there was two of them. We had put out two. Wow. And so I just remember him putting this prickly pear pad on my face. Like duct taping a pad to my face because of the burn. But same thing, man. Those stories, y'all, listen, James and I are sharing stories. And if you're out there and you're thinking, hey, I'm an educator, I haven't had that problem, congratulate yourself. You don't want those stories. Those were mistakes on my part, and I'm not going to speak for James, but it was cool now in retrospect, but like, people could have been hurt, land could have been torched, businesses could have failed. Like, you don't want these things happening, folks. So listen to me, just study all the parameters of what could be the worst case scenario and then prepare for those accordingly.
I give you one more story.
Yeah, of course. Okay. Dude, keep going.
This is one time I did screw up. Me and a co-instructor screwed up. This was at Alderleaf. We were teaching an overnight shelter building course to the year-long intensive group. And we knew it was going to rain, and we had relied on a shelter that an instructor had built previously for us. It was like a little lean-to. And we looked at it and we're like, eh, it should be fine.
Oh, God.
Yep. And we focused our pure attention on all the others building their shelters. And then it got to about, it was dark at that point, so it was probably around 6 or 7 o'clock. Everyone was finished. They were all inside their shelters, and they were all having fires. And then we looked at our shelter and we're like, crap, this thing's a piece of shit. Rain was just gushing through the shelter. And we're like, well, that ruins our night. Like, we're not going to fall asleep. And we can't share a shelter with our students. It's just big enough for them to hang out in. And we're not going to deprive them of that. And so we decided that we were just going to build a really, really big fire. And so we spent probably about 2 hours trying to find dry materials to be able to get this fire going. And my buddy, he had his jacket, and he was like hovering over me trying to provide like an umbrella effect for me, trying to cover me from the rain. And after about 2 hours, yeah, we finally got a little flame, and we just started taking the inside of our shelter that was still dry and feeding it in there and getting it bigger and bigger until it got to the point where the flames were as tall as me.
Oh, my God.
And yeah, so I was probably able to stand about 3 feet away from it, and any rain that hit me was instantly just gone, vaporized. Yeah. And so we just maintained that fire the whole night, and it got so hot that we were taking sopping wet punky wood logs, tossing it in there, and it would just get rid of the moisture immediately and start burning the fuel instantly. And I was like, holy crap, this thing is hot.
Dude.
And yeah, we just did that all night. We just slept next to the fire and chips. So I was like, all right, I'll feed it for 2 hours, you feed it for 2 hours. And it was a miserable night. And when we woke, and we had a couple of nights, because the next day we're like, great, whatever sucked about your shelter, let's fix that, and then we'll do it again. And so while they were building up their shelters, like, all right, we got to actually make something nice for ourselves. Yeah, because we cannot do another night like that. It was terrible.
That's impressive to get a fire that big and that hot in Washington, you know, because like you said, it's just such a task.
It really is, yeah.
Painstaking to go and just get any type of fire going there. Very cool, man. Well, this has been a lot of fun, and I'm super excited. So tell us, you're leaving Austin, Texas, you're heading to New York, and you're going to be at Lime Hollow. Like, how can we find you there? Are you going to be teaching classes for adults, for kids? Y'all got an Instagram? Do you have anything where we can follow you at Lime Hollow?
Yeah, so they do have an Instagram. I think it's, if you just type in Lime Hollow Nature Center, the Instagram will pop up. And then, you know, the website is the greatest way to find classes, and it will also have about the staff and things like that and contact information. And yeah, that's the goal. Is right now they don't have any real weekend classes for children or adults, and so they want to create something called, they're called the Naturalist Series, where every weekend, or not every weekend, but like once a month, hopefully, they'll be doing some sort of skill for kids and parents to be able to learn.
Nice.
So
great.
That's what we're going to set up, yeah.
Dude, it's going to be amazing. Well, I'm super eager to see it grow, and I know that we're all going to miss you here, because James has been helping us at Natureversity for the past few months, running camps and facilitating all kinds of great experiences for the kids with stone tools and fire and everything else. So we're looking forward to having you return, man.
Yeah, I can't wait. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Everybody, thank y'all again for tuning in. It's another episode of the Natureversity podcast. We'll see y'all in the next one. Y'all take care.